Don't you guys, you're going to make me cry. My name is Richard Eugene Michael Patrick R., and I'm an alcoholic. I hang out at the Turning Point. You know, I got the most ridiculous phone call yesterday morning. Bob Darrow called me up. Bob D., excuse me. Called me up at 8:30 and said, Richard, I'm just calling to remind you that you're speaking tomorrow night. Remind me, for Christ's sake. I haven't been able to think of anything else for 2 weeks. I can remind a person the day before. Sure, folks, you know. Only an alcoholic. The obsession about this whole thing, and you keep telling yourself, don't think about it. So all you do is think about it. Yeah. But here I am, and the format for speakers is what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. It's been that way ever since I first came into the program, so that's the way I'll go with it. I was born in the 30s, and to a wonderful Irish Catholic mother and father. I had brothers and a sister, and I thought I had a rather normal childhood. I was jealous of my older brother Bill because he was a junior, and he liked to do things with Pop, and I didn't particularly like to go fishing and all that kind of shit. I stayed home and drew with my mother. I liked to do cartoons and draw cartoons and read and did all that kind of stuff. When I was invited fishing with the boys, I usually ended up throwing rocks in the water to see how pretty the circles would look as they rippled across the pond. So they'd all kick me out and say, I go on home and paint, you know. So that's what I did. I went home and painted. Went through Catholic school. Those nuns were just wonderful. I had a lot of catechism. I knew all those words real good. I knew that anything I did that I liked was sin. I knew if it was really good feeling, it was a mortal sin. And if it just made you kind of feel a little bit better, then it was a venial sin. And then you had to go tell the priest that you promised you would never do it again when you knew damn well as soon as you went outside you were planning on doing it again. Or that I was probably going to do it. And yet I wanted to be a good person. I think alcoholics are people who basically want to be good. Inside us there beats a conscience, you know? Someone once told me the definition of an alcoholic is a drunk with a conscience. And I believe that. Because we don't seem to be able to get away with the things that other people seem to be getting away with. It eats at our guts and tears us apart and makes us drink to forget how we feel. And I think that kind of started way back when I was little, when I was just a kid, because I was feeling the guilt all the time. And I wanted to be good, and I couldn't seem to come up to the standards. The rules were too hard. I couldn't be who, I didn't think I could be who my father wanted me to be. I couldn't be who the nuns wanted me to be. I couldn't be who my brothers wanted me to be. And so I wasn't who I wanted to be. And that was the most painful thing of all. So I would try and pretend I was other people. Try and pretend I was something that I wasn't. And that went on until when I was 12 years old. I came home from school one day and I said, Dad, guess what the nun said today? I really appreciated it. And he said, what? And I said, well, she said that we're supposed to love everybody. And I said, I think that's the best news I've ever heard, that this is a loving world and we're supposed to be able to love everybody. And he said, yes, son, that's right. And I said, good, because I have a crush on Eugene Petrie and I have a crush... And I have a crush on Jermaine Gouillard. And a boy and a girl in my, I guess, 7th, 8th grade class, something like that. Well, I mean, you want to push an Irish Catholic father's buttons, just tell him you're bi, you know. And this was back in the 50s when my father, the only bi he knew was a sickle. And... he started sending me to some shrinks, and three of them kept their hands off me, and, and And one of them said he could fix me. And I went home and I said, Dad, that man said he could fix me. I guess I was about 15 by then. That he could fix me, but it was going to cost $180,000 and I'd be in a sanitarium for maybe even a year. I said, I have a better idea. Give me $180,000, I'll split 10 and you won't see my ass again. You know? Because I didn't want to get changed. I was who I was, and I, you know, that was something that came out of my gut when I was 12. And the world and society and teachers and priests and everybody was trying to tell me I wasn't who I was. And that was one thing that I did know, that I could love anybody. And I didn't want to give that up. I thought it was a special gift from God. And to this day, I still feel that way, and I still feel that way inside me. That's the way I am. And I accept me today, and there ain't nothing wrong with it. I had a few troubles trying to tell other people that. Because it's funny, when you swing down the middle, it's amazing how the street parts in the middle, you know? If you're running around with the gay crowd, the straight people hate your ass. If you're running around with the straight people, the gay people consider you a traitor. It was terrible. It was a lonely street down that middle, you know? I thought, talk about a minority, Jesus Christ. You know. But, so I made it through high school, going back and forth, my God, it was confusing. Didn't know whether to be a basketball player or a cheerleader. This is serious shit, folks. Now, not very traumatic. I ended up going to college to study business because I wanted to be an artist. I had the talent, but my father said, no son of mine is going to starve in a garret in Paris or something. If I'm going to send you to school, you're going to learn what I want you to learn. I said, okay, you son of a bitch, what school? And so I ended up getting a degree in business administration. I then said, up yours, and I'm going to go get a degree in art. And my father said, up yours, you just got drafted. My father was on my draft board. And when the shrinks didn't work, I guess he thought the army could take over. You know, I had news for him. I learned things in that army. But one thing I learned was how to drink good. I tell you, the Army was the place where I learned that if you drink and you drink with people who are your bosses, that you don't have to get in trouble the next morning. And there were ways around of getting out of things. I went in there real stupid. I was going to be the best soldier the USA ever had. I was there a week and I was trying to figure out how I could get my ass out of anything they wanted to put it in, because that was just the way that was to be a successful soldier, was to see how much you could get out of. And that was a pretty hideous 2 years. I ended up a personnel clerk, so I dummied my records and I got out in 18 months. And well, I had a party to go to in Fort Worth, and it was a debutante coming out party, not mine. And I was one of the eligible bachelors, believe it or not. And so I went there, and there was this very beautiful lady who was an Italian princess. And I fell madly in love, and she fell in love. And I went home, and I said, Daddy, I got news for you. I'm getting married. And he said, well, who are you marrying? And I said, I'm marrying Principessa Raffaella. Won't say her last name here. He said, well, that's new. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, that'll be the first time a princess married a queen. My father and I, by this time, had established a good working relationship, as you can tell. And I said, Daddy, that's not true. It happens all the time in England. So I went over and I lived in Italy for 4 years with that marriage. It broke up. I came back to the States with a nervous breakdown, and the alimony was sufficient. I didn't complain about that, but I just kind of was all afloat. I only had 5 years alimony coming, too. But I'm a painter, and I was doing very well in my career. I'm a good painter. And painting and alcohol seemed to go together for me. I didn't have a boss. I didn't have anybody telling me I had to get up, anybody telling me when to go to bed. I just went in there and slapped some paint on some canvas, and some fool thought it was good looking and paid me a lot for it. And that's how I lived. However, after the breakdown, they put me in a sanitarium in Phoenix, which I loved. It was Club Med, you know. I can understand people who get institutionalized, because I was my first day, you know. I loved it. Just, it was really kind of pretty, and the room wasn't too bad. I'd stayed in worse motels. They had little wire cages around the light bulbs, and I thought, well, they think I'm going to do myself in. I love it here. Why should anybody want to kill themselves? Out there is where I want to kill myself, not when I'm here in this place. Because they had a nice swimming pool and nice people, interesting people, the most interesting people I ever met. You know, they say, like, sometimes you come into AA, you know you belong. Well, I belonged in that sanitarium, and I was home, you know. And there was an ex-president's wife was drying out there with me. I didn't know I was drying out. I thought I was coming out of an emotional trauma. But Mamie Eisenhower and I would sit around that swimming pool and drink our iced tea with Librium in it, thinking, this is good. You know, she had the most interesting stories. And then we'd look at that poor old bitch over there. What's wrong with her? I don't know, you know. The gossip that went around, it was wonderful. And then, and the dance every Friday night, and I could pick whoever I want, and no one gave a shit, you know. The menu was limited, but and it's very hard to eat liver with your fingers because they wouldn't allow you no knife. But it had its drawbacks. But it was better than out there for me. I tell you that I was safe and I felt secure inside that place. And I was there for about a month, and they told me, Richard, you know, you have to leave now. A month and a half maybe. I said, oh no, please, I'm not well. I said, no, you don't know what you're releasing out there. I'm not ready to go. Just because you moved me into minimum security doesn't mean diddly shit, you know. And I said, please, let me teach ceramics in the ceramics class, you know. Because I used to work in the Army, you know. You volunteer for So I was released into the outside world again. It was my first AA meeting. They mentioned that I go to an AA meeting. This was in like 1960, I guess, somewhere back then. They mentioned that I go to an AA meeting on Central Boulevard in Phoenix at the Episcopal Church. And so my mom picked me up out of the hospital, and I said, I got to go to a meeting tonight of some kind over at the Episcopal Church. And she said, Episcopal Church? And I said, yeah, you know, I guess they got drunks there too. And so I went to it, and I didn't identify with anything. Number one, they were all old. I was not that old. And I went home, and Mom said, well, how was it? And I said, well, it's kind of interesting. The Episcopals drink about like the Catholics. But I just didn't think that that was the place for me. But I knew the States wasn't either, because I'm an escape person. I want to get out. And I couldn't live under the pressure of living at home under my parents with them watching me, you know, knowing that I was going to get drunk. I mean, the scenes around the house were getting pretty bad. One time, I came in around 4 o'clock in the morning, and my family was sitting around waiting for me to come home, and I ran in and screamed, I hate you, and I'm going to kill myself. And I ran out and got my little MGT up, and I was going to drown myself. And I crashed through the redwood fence and drove into the swimming pool. And unfortunately, the end of the swimming pool closest to the driveway was the shallow end. And the car just went in and started roll. And my father came out and said, let go of the wheel, because my ass was floating up in the air. An oil slick on a swimming pool is a frightful thing to see. So I figured I better get back to my beloved Italy, where everyone loved me and they drank wine like I did. Because I'm a wino. I mean, I love my wine. And you know, who cares what year? Good grief. I could care less, and I had arrived, and I had a wine cellar. And it had some good bottles, and had, I knew a bunch of people that own vineyards and things, and they'd always bring over good bottles. And I don't know, there's something about me that wouldn't let me drink them. I'd just stash them. And I'd go out and buy the cheap shit down at the grocery store, you know, the big bottles, you know. That's what counted, you know. All you used wine for was to wash the food down anyway. Everybody knows you can't swallow unless you have a glass of wine to go push it on down. And I don't think I chewed for 8 years, you know. I didn't, and you know, a lot of alcoholics die of strangulation. It goes on the records of strangulation, but we really don't chew. We're real lazy at the dinner table when we're drunk. And we just kind of go, nom, 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 like that. And look at Mama Cass, you know. She got down quite a few meals before she went, though. So I went back to my precious Italy to drink and to paint. My reputation was getting good. The paintings were selling like mad, and I would get disgruntled with Italy. I'd say, it must be the neighborhood. All those people speaking Italian all the time, you know. So I would move, and I would move to Denmark, or I'd move to Holland, or I'd move to Africa. Well, I had a one-man show in Africa, and so I stayed there a very short period of time. But I was all the time moving around, trying to find a place where I fit. But you know, like all us alcoholics, there was no place where I could go because I didn't fit in my head. Any place I went, I brought the trouble. And it was my gut and it was my head. And sure, I could cosmetically fix the world. I could get away from people who knew me and become somebody else at a new place. But then who I was would catch up with me and people would start finding out that I wasn't capable of being responsible. That I was a complete asshole just drifting through life. And I couldn't stand the thought that people that liked me would begin to know me. So I had to move. I had to keep going. But I kept on going back to my house in Florence because that was base. I had to have a home. I had to have a place that I would walk in where my dog was. My poor dear dog. I love that thing. I don't know how many of you have a pet that in your drinking was something special to you. But that dog loved me unconditionally. And that's what I was looking for because I needed love so bad. And I was rather immoral by this time, considerably. I had three categories of people in my life. There were the people who I was hot for, but was too afraid to ask. There were the people who liked me and I liked them, but no big deal. And then there was the people who were real trolls that adored me, and who do you think I'd end up with? I'd end up with the troll, thinking about that one and aiming at the other one, you know. Real mess, but it was very confusing. All kinds of people in and out of my life an awful lot. And the more that happened, the more I drank, because you know, I'm a moral person. I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't want to be a tramp. I don't want to be a whore. And I don't want to be a rich whore. And that's what was beginning to happen. It was getting so that I could afford people. And instead of being the whore, I became, started buying them. And not on a daily basis and not on a trick kind of a basis, but I started accumulating people in my life through what God had given me, through my talent. And that made you feel even worse because you knew it. You knew there was no feeling. They were just there for what they could get. But somehow it didn't matter anymore because I so desperately needed somebody saying you're okay because I was sinking. Inside me, I was sinking. The suicide attempts had been starting again. I was declared dead once in Italy. I sliced my wrists. I had sliced my wrists many times, but once I was declared dead, and because I had gotten in a bathtub so I wouldn't coagulate with hot water, and they shipped me on home. One time in Florence, I was terribly despondent and sitting at my wooden butcher block table, and I thought, and I had an ice pick. I'm going to do me in. I'm so tired of hurting. And I turned my hand over and I took the ice pick and jammed it through my hand, through my wrist. And I got stuck to the damn table. And I thought, oh no. I'm going to pass out. My friggin' arm is going to be up there. You know. Well, I was trying to imagine how the arm would go as I fell, and I thought, so I'm going, that's a hell of a way to go. Don't ever try it on a butcher block table. Also, do not use razor blades on kitchen countertops because the formica dulls the blade. All kinds of hints. You know, I can come in here and talk about those things with you people and hear the laughter, because I love that. Because you go out there and at a cocktail party and someone says, what's that on your wrist? You say, oh, that was my suicide attempt. Oh, what's that on that wrist? Oh, that's when the ice pick went through my hand. Watch the reaction. You say something like that in AA and they say, well, why did you go back and forth? You're supposed to go up and down. God bless us, you know. We're so inept at it, you know. We're so bad at it. The only thing I didn't ever try to use was a gun, and that's because it was so final. As you can tell, I was not happy in Italy, and the Italians were not happy with me in Italy. Little poison pen letters from the police in my post box. So I decided I had to come back to the States for my sanity, because I knew I was in deep trouble, real deep trouble. I had been purchased by two of the major museums in New York City, and so probably for the last 6 months I was in Florence, I was sitting there with Peggy Lee's record. In fact, you know, Peggy Lee was on tonight on the Channel 11, and she was singing my drinking song, Is That All There Is? And it amazed me. I thought, isn't that something? Before I come here, and I haven't heard that song in a long time, but that was the song that I used to drink to in Florence with my cognac, just pouring it down. Is that all there is? Jesus, I've arrived, everything I wanted, and look at me. I'm crying and trying to kill myself. What's wrong? Something's desperately wrong. I didn't know if I was crazy. I didn't know it was the booze. The booze was the last thing I was willing to blame. It must be where I lived. It must be the neighborhood. It must be my lover. Well, he was, yeah, fucking, excuse me. I had to make an amends to that one. And so I came back to this country. I landed in New York. I had a business manager, and they turned over to me a very large sum of money. And I said, what are you doing? He says, this is the money you have left over from your painting days, and you didn't spend it all. He said, you would just get so much money in this. It was over $300,000 left. And I said, but you don't understand, I'm crazy, and I can't even shake your hand. My wrists are taped from the last stitches in my wrist. Please, you can't do that to me. I'll kill myself with that money. The money will be my instrument of death, especially in New York. I was terrified. I was terrified of New York City. I hadn't been in this country for 8 years. I didn't understand Americans, much less New Yorkers. Who understands them, for Christ's sake? Yeah. And they were so abrasive. I'd say, buongiorno, what in the hell do you want? You know, entirely different kind of people. And I was scared, and I was timid, and I was running. So the only thing for me to do was find a nice place, get in a good stash, and sack out, you know? So I spent an awful lot of time. I lived in New York for 7 months and changed my apartment 6 times because it must be the neighborhood, you know. Everybody else seemed to be living pretty good, but right around me was this space of disaster and doom. Just like everywhere I walked, I was getting into trouble everywhere. The people I was hanging out with, the parties I'd get invited to. I mean, New York has some of the sickest people on earth, as far as being bent when it comes to what's a good time at a party. God, my. I thought I'd seen some pretty hairy things in Tijuana till I hit New York. But those people just laid me cold. I ain't gonna survive this. And you know, I almost didn't. I had to leave New York. And so what do? I went to Hollywood, California. Where all the normal people hang out. And by this time I was a full-fledged screaming alcoholic. I had been taking pills too. You know, when I first came in, he'd say, well, thank God I didn't have a drug problem. What a bold lot of shit, because I was taking pills from the time I was in that lovely sanitarium and they introduced me to them. Because in Italy, they were across-the-counter drugs. You needed no prescription, and I could walk in and order 50 Valiums here, 100 Libiums here, my second all's over at this drugstore. I had a closet full of pills, which when you're a wino, gets very confusing because you cannot remember which was which and what you've done. And on one of my suicide attempts, they said, we can't believe you're alive, because they had found that I had been drinking 2 six-packs of beer, a fifth of cognac, and a gallon of wine a day for about 6 months. And on top of that, they didn't even know my pill intake. I was just, and talk about diarrhea, Jesus. I own nothing but dark-colored pants for a long time. It's so nice to be able to wear white. So I ended up in L.A. and finished the rest of the money. I went back to Phoenix and told my parents that I was going to join AA, so I had to go back to L.A. Why, I don't know. Why I thought that was where AA was, I have no idea. Only. But I came back to L.A. and got drunk in Palm Springs. My car turned into a bar by itself in Palm Springs. I do not remember that. It was a blackout. Must have been a sober blackout. But I had the first four-day blackout of my life, and I came to at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and I called the desk, and I said, this is Mr. Riley in room number, let me see. And I had to go look, and I came back, and I he said, oh, you speak English? I said, yeah, of course I do. And he said, well, we had to have an Italian translator for 3 days. And I said, 3 days? I've been here 3 days. He said, you've been here four. And I said, my God, where is my car? They said, well, you came here from Palm Springs in a taxi cab. I said, oh, that's right. Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, that's it. That's the ticket. And so I quick called the family lawyer in Phoenix and said, but I've lost my car again. He said, no, you sold the Austin Healey for $25 in Palm Springs. And then I looked down and I was dressed in a floor-length fur coat. And I was naked underneath it. And it was hot, too, in Los Angeles. And I was all covered in blood. From top to toe, I was all covered in blood. And I ran in the bathroom to see if I'd been stabbed or in some way wounded. And it wasn't my blood. I don't know where I was. It may have been a snuff movie. I was gone for 4 days. I have no idea. But I knew then that I had to really do something. So I made my first phone call to central office in AA. And somebody answered the phone and they said, central office. And I said, my name is Richard. And she said, my name is Maureen and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I don't give a shit what your problem is, lady. You know, I called you up because I'm not feeling good and you're starting to tell me your problems. I said, I called you because there's an outside chance that just possibly, maybe, that there's in the realm of some possibility that just I might possibly kind of maybe have a little bit of inclination towards alcoholism. She said, you sure sound like one. And then she asked me the second dumbest question I ever heard. She said, well, are you sober? Well, how in the hell do I know? I just came out of a four-day blackout. I could be loaded to the gills. I don't know. I said, I have no idea. She said, well, we'll come by and pick you up. And they did, and they took me to my first meeting. Well, I thought my first meeting, no way am I going to, you know, drinking in raincoats and brown paper bags. Jeez, you can't go to that, Richard. So I got out my favorite suit. It was a Bill Blass brown velvet cocktail suit. That sucker was designed for drinking in New York. It was spiffy. I mean, it wasn't like a regular suit. It looked like a drinking suit. It was my favorite piece of clothing. So I got dressed up in my Bill Blass brown velvet cocktail suit, and they came by and picked me up, and I went to the first meeting. And the first thing I hated about AA was that they had fluorescent lights. I hate fluorescent. All those terrible lights and a mirror. Jesus, forget the mirrors. I hadn't seen how I looked in a long time. And all these people looked pretty good, and I looked like I couldn't believe my brown velvet cocktail suit. There was some dried barf on the collar. You know, Dad never showed up in a bar. And the crotch was so stiff, I could have stood him in the corner. But I was looking good for my first meeting, you know. I was not one of you lower types, you know. And I'm sitting in the room, and I'm looking around saying, I wonder who probably drank more I did. I wonder who was probably in the same kind of cocktail lounge I was. And I found this beautiful lady dressed in a black dress, and she had pearls on her. And she's pretty classy. So she was the one I thought I'd get close to. And she was the speaker that night. That's why she was so dressed up. And I thought, you know, she's really not, what a lady, what a beautiful person. Yeah, maybe she belonged to the same country club. I never belonged to a country club. But maybe she did. And so I'm sitting there thinking, boy, you sure can pick them, Richard. And that lady got up and she started talking about what it used to be like. And my hair stood on end, worse than this. It was... She started talking about losing her jailhouse strut because she'd done so much time as a whore walking the streets in East L.A. And I'm, God almighty, you know, I probably did drink in the same place as she did. It just rocked me back. I couldn't believe it. That was in 1970 that I first came into this program. I moved to Las Vegas when I was 6 months sober. And my first sponsor drank the day I was supposed to move here. My first sponsor was really nice. I picked him because he was 7 years sober and very screwed up. And because I couldn't handle saints, you know, Mother Teresa's were not in my category. But I needed someone who was sober and living, screwing up, but enjoying life. And I found them. There's a lot of them in these rooms, you know. So he said, Richard, you're going to have to make a lot of changes in your life, 180-degree changes. I said, no problem. I'm used to making 180-degree turns. He says, then you're going to spend a lot of time on your knees in the bedroom. I said, no problem. He said, well, we're going to have to change some of the rules. You're going to have to get up off of your knees, go to bed, and say your prayers. And I said, okay. And I loved him a lot and was very, very afraid when I came here because he had drank. Because I saw a person dissolve. He had what I wanted. And then he didn't have anything I want. And it happened like that. You know, I couldn't believe it. Here was this person who had his shit together, and all of a sudden, 2 days later, he was a tired drunk sitting at a table drinking his aftershave lotion. I'll never forget the horror of seeing that. And I had to come here all alone, and I didn't know anybody, and he had known Vegas, and so I thought, God, you know, now I have to go up there alone. And I walked into the Thai club, and 1970 people were a little gaudy, at least I was, and we had about 8 rings, 10 necklaces, you know, kind of clanked into my first meeting. There was a little bit of bigotry around. Now, that's true. I know that this place has grown a lot. But believe me, in 1970, when you swung into the Thai club, if you weren't a bricklayer or a pipe setter, you were strange material. So I had to realize, I had a couple of rough things said to me my first meeting, and I thought, Richard, no one can keep you out of AA. If you have a sincere desire to be sober, no one can not let you into these meetings. And if people are prejudiced or if people are bigoted, you're used to it your whole life in the outside world, why do you expect people in AA to be any different? You know what? People in AA, I find, are different. Some are. Some have yet things to learn. But basically, the people in these rooms that love me, and I know that there's an awful lot of people in this room that love me and that I love very much, have made no judgment on me. And I don't make any judgments on you. I love you for who you are because I feel the love coming at me because you love me for who I am. And that's what this program has given me, an ability to love me, which allows me to love you for whoever you are. And I will believe you until you tell me something else. I have to trust you. I have to begin somewhere in my life to trust, or else I'm back to that cynic who never believes anybody, who doubts everything. And that's the way back to drinking for me. I've loved my years in AA. I was 3 years sober and feeling just fine, just great. And I went into a Mexican food restaurant and I ordered a taco, an enchilada, a margarita, and a bean burro, I think. And the waitress brought it to the table and I thought, well, look at that. I guess my body is craving salt. So I ate the salt off the edge and then I threw it down. And then of course you have to have beer because the food doesn't go down unless you have the beer to go with it. That one lasted 3 days. It wasn't continual drinking, but it was an amazing, immediate loss of a higher power. My spirituality went out the window with the first. There is no way in this body for any kind of spiritual life and any kind of mood-altering chemical, any mood-altering chemical whatsoever. I happen to be one of those kind who believe that if you're using anything that alters reality, that you're not sober, because I've experienced the other side of that. I was sober for 2 years after that. I'm so grateful to get back in the program. And I was at a party in Los Angeles, and they were passing a stick around, and I said, no thanks, I don't do that no more. No thanks, I don't do that no more. Maybe just a little teeny. So I said, no big deal, I'm handling it, I'm not stoned, I'm not sleeping around, I'm dealing with this thing, I can smoke a little grass if I want. Look at that, pass that thing back over here. Get that back over here. Mine, mine. Roll up another one, I'm almost finished this one. I knew about five people in the program at the time who smoked grass and still claimed to have sobriety. So I immediately the next morning called up all five and said, I had a little teeny bit of pot last night. And they said, no, Richard, this is a program for alcoholics. And if you didn't drink, then you still have your sobriety. I said, oh, thanks, thanks. But you know, it didn't wash. It didn't wash in my gut, I knew. And I called my sponsor, who was very spiritual. And I said, Eddie, do you think? He said, you know you have. He said, I've heard, and yes, you did. So go raise your hand and go back to a meeting. And after, you know, oh, God. So I didn't. I went out and got drunk because I wasn't ready. My ego was such that I was not going to waste a raising of a hand for 30 days just for one lousy stick of grass. By God, I'm going to tie one on before I go back. I don't know if anybody identifies with that. So I did, and I came back 4 days later, beat, spiritually wiped out, so grateful to be back in these rooms. I was sober for a year and a half, and I was in the supermarket buying all the staples that an alcoholic buys. I had ice cream, cookies, all the my good food, the junk food was at McDonald's. This was my serious shopping. And those little black rubber belts that they put your groceries on moved, and it moved my groceries right in, well, it looked right into the liquor department. And so I just followed them on in and got me a vodka and some beer. And you know the amazing thing about alcohol, or about me and alcohol anyway, my story, I was absolutely high and I was insane before I even broke that snap on that bottle. I was stoned just when I bought it. I can go crazy before I drink and then I go crazier. If I don't maintain my program, if I don't go to meetings, if I don't do the steps, believe me, I can get just as crazy as if I'm loaded. Because I was loaded when I bought it. Absolutely. I was high. I felt the rush. It was almost like a popper. And you know, like that. That I had purchased that, and I knew I was buying it for me to go into me. I had bought booze before for parties, but it wasn't mine. This was mine, and I meant it. And I got high. I got high before I opened that. And that one lasted a week, and it was the most terrifying, awful week of my life. Because for the first time in my whole drinking career, in my whole sober career, I had trouble getting the willingness to be willing to come back into this program. I had been so lucky, I had been so blessed for a 3-day excursion and a 4-day excursion. But this was the first time I came to a meeting and went and got drunk after. It was terrifying. I had never done that before. It was the first time I ever showed up at a meeting drunk. I was horrified. What am I doing here? Look at me, I'm stoned. The humiliation. But I had to come back. I was trying desperately to get back to this program because I knew if I went too far, I wasn't going to last too long. I knew it as sure as I was in that bar drinking. And I was terrified. So I finally called my sponsor July 19th, 1976, and I said, Ted, I just gotta. And I've been sober by the grace of God for 11 years last July 19th. Was I supposed to stop at 9? It's 9 o'clock, the turnoff. Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get so hung up in all the past. If you don't mind, let me talk a little longer about my gratitude for being in the program. They've been wonderful 11 years. They've given me, life is what it's all about to me. It's not just getting sober. It's learning how to deal with life on life's terms. It's learning how to cope with unresolved problems. It's learning that I'm okay no matter what's going on out there. I come into AA to learn how to deal with the world out there. I don't come to AA to learn how to live and deal with alcoholics. No, that ain't enough for me. I'm tired of boxing myself and putting labels on my back and saying, you are comfortable in this society, you are comfortable in that society. Today I am comfortable in the world, folks. I go out there and I belong everywhere. I belong in gay bars, straight bars, I belong in churches, I belong in libraries, I belong anywhere where there's people, because I'm me, and I belong in the world. And I come into AA to learn how to do that. And I don't do it real well. None of us do it very well. But if we keep coming back here, we develop techniques and learning skills and disciplines and responsibilities that we've never known before. And you know, those very things that used to terrify me are the things that I thirst for today. I grab them and I love them and I want them because I want to grow up. I want to be who I'm supposed to be. And slowly and surely this is happening to me in sobriety. I grasp my sobriety and I cherish it so much because I ain't who I used to be no more. I know what I can be and I know what I am. That was the past. I don't know who I'm going to be, but if I keep going like I'm going, chances are I'm going to live quite content within this body for the rest of my life, as long as I keep coming to these meetings. But the most important thing AA has given me is that I know who I am today and I love me. I love me today, I wouldn't change me. I love my defects because it gives me some place to grow. There'd be nothing worse than being perfect, because that would be, is that all there is, as far as I'm concerned? There's one little thing that I have in the back of my head that sometimes I think, well, maybe, Richard, when you're like 80 or 84, when you're on your deathbed, I mean, really down, laid out, and the family's gathering around, and my daughter and all these people are there, and the nurse is saying, shh, 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 he's about ready to go, he's about ready to go. And I'm going to be listening, right? And she's going to say, he's about ready to take his last breath. I have this awful feeling I'm going to say, can I have a little glass of champagne? But you know, you think the drink through, and I think it would be just my luck to have that champagne kick this thing back in. They'd be wheeling me into a friggin' AA meeting, raising my hand.
So I got this job and I loved it. Minimum wage, 2-something an hour. Best job I ever had. I loved it. There was some restriction in my life. I was expected to be here at a certain time and I had to leave at a certain time. I needed that. I needed discipline. I never had any. And I loved it. It felt good. It felt good to belong. And I belonged in a workplace and I belonged in AA and it was terrific. I wasn't Richard out there floating around. And I could let you people know who I was. I'm glad I did that kind of quick. I did not come into AA. I thought if I'm ever going to learn to trust people with who I am, I better start in AA. I better let you know when I come in who I am and what I'm about. I can camouflage. I have no intention of hiding. I have no intention of having some of you think I'm one thing and some of you thinking I'm another. That's how I had lived my whole life. I came in here, Richard Riley, this is it, folks. Take it or leave it. It's all I got. And you know what? You people said, keep coming back. And some of you didn't. Some of you were bigoted, some of you were prejudiced, some of you may be tonight. Hey, you know, keep coming back. We've all got our growing to do. And that's how I was received, and that's one reason why I loved AA so much. That it was a non-judgmental, we don't judge in these rooms. And I knew that, and I knew the love, and I knew the people could love me for who I was. And I can't tell you how I reveled in that. It was a wonderful basking of love and caring over me without anybody condemning me. And I needed that. I really needed that in order to get going with my life. And you people gave it to me. And you allowed me to be me, and you allowed me to be crazy, and you allowed me to all my idiosyncrasies, because that's how I was, and that's who I was, and you were patient with me. And I came to this town, and I'm an interior designer. God gave me a business right away. 6 months after I sobered up, I was an interior designer in this town. I had a beautiful woman for a partner. 7 years that lasted. I went to another job. God placed a beautiful woman in my life, Michelle. I fell in love with her, married. We were married for 8 years. I have a beautiful 12-year-old little girl from that marriage. Love her to death, the apple of my eye, my dear little Leslie. That marriage broke up 10 years ago. She was 2 years old. Because I didn't want any more kids, and she did. I was 47, 48 when Leslie was born. And so I had a vasectomy, and I came home from work 5 days later, and my house was empty. The baby was gone, the furniture was gone. She left me a cup and a saucer and a spoon and said, you alcoholic, love coffee. And I passed out. I thought I was having a heart attack. I just passed out cold at this empty house, this void, this emptiness. I had never experienced anything like it in my life. And I had to do it sober. I didn't have an anesthesia. I couldn't grab a pill. I couldn't run and grab a bottle. I had to feel the stuff, and I did not want to feel it. I didn't know. I was heading into territory that was unknown to me. I had never allowed pain in my life. I knew what to do if I started hurting, or even if I thought I was going to start hurting. I could take a drink so I could say I don't give a shit. But I gave a shit, and I had to feel it. And it took me a long time. It took me about a year and a half of you people loving me and allowing me to cry in the meetings and allowing me to say I can't handle it. I think I'm going to go crazy sober. You know, just because I'm sober doesn't mean I can't go crazy. I can hurt so much, I can flip out. People commit suicide sober. That's the truth. You know, I had to reach in, and I needed you people more than I've ever needed anybody in my life. I needed a higher power more than I ever needed a higher power. It was the only thing that was going to see me through, because I didn't have my anesthesia anymore, and I could not touch that. And I was sober long enough to know that. That I could not go back and take away the pain the way I used to. Because if you do that, you just have to feel it on down the road, and you've made it worse. I had to deal with it and go through it, and you people allowed me the time it took. And I came through it. I have a good relationship with that wife today, the ex-wife, because of this program. I did not hate her. I hurt, and it was unfortunate, but how could I hate her? Because I had done what I thought I had the right to do to protect Richard. She had the right to react to what I had done. And if I was going to give myself the right to have the vasectomy, I had to give her the right to react the way she did. I didn't want her to. I didn't like it. I think in the back of my mind, I didn't think she would. But her focus on motherhood, her desire to have more children, was that strong, and my desire not to have children was that strong. It just came down to that. You can't compromise and have half a baby. She's had two children since. And she called me up once, and she said, Richard, do you ever regret having the vasectomy? And I said, no, honey. I have regretted maybe what that caused, but I have never regretted taking care of Richard. Because you're looking at a people pleaser who would do anything for anybody in order not to upset them or not to make waves. I took care of me, and I had to learn to take the result of that and put it into my life. And I said, no, I don't regret it. I'm very grateful that I have my daughter. For whatever time, I have quality time with her. Sure, she's not living with me. Some other man she's calling daddy. That was hard, first time I heard him call her daddy. Ugh. Take that knife out. Ugh. Rip again. Open up the wound. It was hard when they moved to Reno 5 months after the divorce, which was another wrenching away. I thought, my God, now I don't even have her daily where I can see her. And that man is raising her up there. But it was very hard. And I didn't want to see her for a while. I can't take the pain of giving her back. I mean, it was wonderful to get her, but then I had to give her back, and it hurt too much. She'd cry, I'd cry. We both be all screwed up for days. And I finally went, Richard, you can't do that. You can't turn your love for this girl into something very painful. You have to be grateful for what God gives you and be grateful for that. And she is not pain. She is not sorrow. She is God's light. She is the beautiful light. She's the sky, and she's the grass, and she's flowers, and she's everything beautiful on God's earth. How dare you turn her into something dark and dismal where you want to hide under a bed and cry? My sponsor told me that. And I believed her. And she said, get up out of that bed and go wash those windows. And when you wash those windows and you have that Kleenex, you look out and say, that's Leslie's love, that sky up there. And that light out there, that's Leslie's love. And it turned me around. And I learned to appreciate my love for my daughter and her love for me. And I don't need it all in order to be happy and content with that love. I'm the best daddy I can be to my little girl. And she knows that. And that's why I have a good relationship with my ex-wife, too. She loves my daughter as much as I do. My ego says, no, I have to be there. But my heart says, if you really love her unconditionally, you let God place your child where God thinks your child should be, and you do the best you can. That's all. And that's all anybody has any right to expect from me. The program's brought me many beautiful things. Many things. Not money things. It's brought me some money. But that's not the cherished things in my life. It's brought me my friends. It's brought me a sense of what makes Richard happy as to what I used to think made me happy. One time when I was, I had a brother, one of my brothers hated my ass because he lived at home when I was going through a lot of the shit. And he never forgave me. I made my amends to him and he never forgave me. And I guess about 5, 6 years ago he called me up and said, Richard, you're not who you used to be anymore. And I can't hate you. I wanted to, but when you come home, you're not who you were. And he said, let me make an amends to you. And I said, okay, Tom. He says, let me take you to London for 3 weeks. And I said, okay, I can handle it. And he said, let's take the Concorde. And I said, hey, I've always wanted to fly on the Concorde. So my dear little rich brother got to take Richard as an amends to London for 3 weeks on the Concorde and back on the Concorde. I never in my life would have ever dreamed my little brother would have done that for me. My little brother never would have done that for me had I not found this program. It was the most beautiful vacation, not because of the Concorde or the limo or the hotels or the restaurants or all the lavishness. It was a beautiful vacation because I sat in the hotel room with a brother that I didn't know. And he sat in the hotel room with a brother who he wanted to know. And we got to know each other. And we're both different people than either of us thought we were. And it was terrific. My little brother and me sitting in London talking stuff after all these years. It was a terrific vacation. And when I was in London, I went to a meeting one afternoon at St. Paul's Cathedral, a noontime meeting, and I went in, and I got there a little early because I'm nervous when I'm out of town, and I like to get to a meeting early, and I walked into the kitchen, and I said, can I help? And she says, you're American, aren't you? And I said, yeah. She says, well, welcome to England. I said, well, what can I do? She says, well, you can make the tea. And I said, oh, excuse me, but you don't understand. No, we drink coffee. She says, well, in England, we drink tea. We drink tea at our meetings. And I said, well, how do you make tea? She said, what do you mean? I said, well, how do you make tea for 50 people? Do you have a giant tea bag or something? Well, she couldn't wait for the meeting to start, so she could run out of the kitchen. Oh, there's Mr. America back at the kitchen. He wants a great big giant tea bag. So I go out of the meeting, and they're all having a great laugh. And there was this guy from Scotland who spoke with such a brogue I couldn't understand him, and he was crying at the same time. And I shared a little at the meeting, and he came up after the meeting. He said, can I talk to you? And I said, sure, let's go have a cup of tea. I told you I'm a switch hitter. So we went across the street to have a cup of tea, and he told me this awful story about how he had, 3 years before, he had thrown, on his last stroke, he had thrown a guy off a bridge in Scotland, and he had run away down to England where there was no extradition. And he had sobered up in England, he had 3 years of sobriety, but he would sneak back up to Scotland to see his wife, who was still up there. And she had gotten pregnant, and the cops were watching his house up there because they were waiting for him to come up to see the wife because she was pregnant. And there was a 750-pound, which is about $1,000 was at the time, or he'd have to spend 2 years in jail. And he didn't know what to do about it. And I said, well, I don't know what to do about it. I said, you know, I've known you for a half hour? Are you asking me for $1,000? He says, oh, no, but he said, you talk so spiritual to me. And I said, well, I'm going to start talking spiritual now, too. I said, why don't we walk all over London? Just show me London from the Scottish truck driver's eyes. And we'll go to places tourists don't go and just kind of, we won't think about the problem. We'll turn it over to a higher power, and that's how we'll deal with this thing. So we walked all over London, and we got back to the hotel, ended up by the hotel. And I said, you stay down here. So I went up the room, and my brother Tom was up there. And I said, Tom, I need $1,000, and you don't get to ask me what it's for, anything about it. Just yes or no, will you give me $1,000 or not? And he said, I don't get to ask what for. And I said, no. He said, okay, here's $1,000. So I went downstairs and I gave John $1,000. And I said, John, this is my name and address in Las Vegas. I don't want to know your last name and I don't want your phone number or address, but take it and God bless you. And on the Concorde on the way home, my brother were on the plane and he says, can you tell me now what that was all about? And I said, yeah, I gave it away. And I told him the story of the Scotsman and the bridge and the body and the whole thing. He says, oh, my God. He says, do the con men hang around outside your meetings waiting for the meeting to end? I said, Tom, no, you don't understand. My higher power told me to do that. He said, are you sure it wasn't his higher power? I never saw that, and I thought, just shut up. I think, you know, I had to do, the way I felt about it, I couldn't afford not to do it. It was the only way I could explain it. Well, then we came back to the States. I sent him that $1,000 real quick, because I did not want him on my case about that. And every time I'd call home to talk to Mom or my brother, he'd say, have you heard from your higher power yet? And it just killed me to say no. And then one day I was at work and my secretary came up and said, Richard, you have a phone call from Scotland. And my heart started beating out, God, I bet it's John. I wonder what's up. So I got to the phone and it was John. And he said, Richard, how are you? And I said, fine. He said, I want you to know that I'm so happy that today we had a wee little boy, a boy born to us here in Scotland. And I want you to know also, if you don't mind, Richard, that you have a godson here, and we named him Richard after you.
Oh, man.
You know, what's $1,000?
Yeah.
You know, as I said earlier, I don't know what makes Richard happy. God knows infinitely more. I would have settled for $1,000. And what does God do? but give me a beautiful kid running around Scotland with my name. That someday his father's going to tell him where his name came from. I mean, and my brother called about 3 weeks later and said, have you heard from the higher power yet? And I said, mm-hmm. He said, no shit. And I told him about John's phone call. And he started crying. And he said, that's really beautiful, Richard. He said, that's beautiful. He said, I guess I believe in your higher power because you believe in your higher power. And you know, that's really kind of the simple basics of the whole thing. If you believe, you got one. My higher power and I have a wonderful relationship. He loves me just the way I am. He wouldn't change a thing. He lets me let him know that I want to. And then he will do it. In his time, not mine. I love the sixth and seventh step because they say we let him do it. We don't do it. We're willing and we ask him to, we pray about it. And God takes care of those things. I think it's terrific. I never could change me. I'm not good at changing, Richard. I resist. But God changes in the most amazing ways, in the easiest, kind, gentle, loving way that God can change us. All we have to do is ask him. I have one more thing and then I'll shut up. I know I'm probably going over. In dealing with my father and that whole situation, it has a good ending. With that relationship that I have with him. The last 10 years of my father's life were the best 10 years of the relationship I've ever had. He was absolutely, we had our fights, we had our problems, but he was willing to change because he saw me changing. And I went home one time and I said, you know, Dad, I would love to have your love, but it is no longer important to me. I no longer need that in order to know that I'm okay. And I would love to have you respect me, and I would love to have you love me. But if that not be the case, I want you to know that I will love you. And it's up to your choice. I can love you from afar, or I can love you from up close. But you can't stop me from loving you. And that was it. And he told my mom later that night, you know, I don't like what Richard said to me, but I respect him for it. And from that little grain of respect that I got from my father by telling him I no longer cared, I no longer needed his approval. We began to have a relationship to try and figure out what kind of relationship we could have. Daddy died 4 years ago of cancer. And when I was down in Phoenix and he told me he was terminal, I said, Dad, you know, would you do me a favor? And he said, what's that? I said, for most of my life, you have always tried to tell me what to do. And I have resisted anything from you. I have always done the opposite of whatever you told me simply because I didn't like hearing it from you. I said, Daddy, I've grown up a lot. I've grown up a lot in the years I've known you. And do me a favor. I'm asking you to teach me how to die. Because I know you're a brave man. And I know you're a courageous man. And I know you're a spiritual person. So please teach me. I will watch you as you go through your process of dying. I can't die for you, I can't take your pain away, but I can be there and comfort you, and I want you to teach me. So that someday when I'm dying, and a nurse comes in and says, Richard, you're doing real good, I want to be able to say, thanks, my dad taught me. So that's how we went through his process. I was there, we talked, he told me his fears, he told me his joys, he told me his little successes, and my daddy taught me how to do it. The day he died, there was always one little thing between my father and I that was not resolved, and it was subliminal, but it was there, and that is, he would, when we had a family get-together, he would hug my brothers, but he would shake my hand. And it was little, but it was there. You know, it was, hi, Tom, hi, Bill, hi, Richard. And it was like, what's he going to do, catch me? You know, kind of a thing. On the day he died, my mom said, you better go in and say goodbye to your father. And I said, okay. But I felt so good because I had no guilt. I had no fears. Everything was resolved. I had resolved everything with Pop. It was terrific. There was no, Daddy, Daddy, I'm sorry. No, it was all taken care of. So I went in to say bon voyage. And I said, Dad, I've seen you walk hand in hand with your higher power, with your God, your whole life. And I guess now you're going to start walking arm in arm with him. Bon voyage. And he said, bend down, bend down. And I thought he had been weakened quite a bit by the cancer. And I thought he wanted to whisper to me. So I bent down like this. And he said, no, no, bend down. And I bent down and my father kissed me on the mouth. And he said, I love you unconditionally. And Daddy died 45 minutes later. When I came out of the room, my mother said, what did your father do for you? I said, what do you mean? She said, you're glowing. You have a glow about you, Richard. And I said, Ma, you know, in all the years, I've always seen Daddy hug my brothers, but I've never seen him kiss them on the mouth. You know, Daddy just gave me the best present he's ever, I mean, the best present I had ever had from Daddy up till then was during the war when he bought me a bicycle, because there weren't any bicycles. And Daddy put one together from spare parts because during the war you couldn't get it. And that was the best present. And on the day he died, the very last thing my Daddy and I ever did, he gave me the best present ever. His love, unconditionally. And Daddy was kind of an important man. They had his funeral was in a cathedral and the bishop said the mass and there were television cameras at the thing. And that night I saw my dad's funeral on television. And there's the family, and there's my brother Tom, and he's crying, and there's my brother Bill, and he's crying, and there my mom is with tears, and she's looking up at me, and I'm glowing. And I had a smile. I was so full of joy. I was so full of gratitude. That man laying in front of me had given me so much. It was so much love. I had never known such peace with my father. I talk to him more today than I ever have. I've never been closer to my father. He is with me at all times. If I had never received anything else from this program, if sobriety, if AA, if my higher power, never had given me anything more than just that one brief, beautiful moment with my father, it would have been worth anything I had been through in sobriety. Sobriety's been so good to me in so many ways, in the ways that really count. And I'm very, very grateful for it. And I'm grateful for you people for letting me talk to you. Thank you.